This is Phil Ferrand. And I am driving home. It's Thursday today. Gotta get on home because we've started small groups back up. This is gonna be our second week. We had a nice time last week. A little challenge because I did have Aiden last Thursday. And Dad had a little bit of a situation at work that he had to deal with, so Aiden there was there for the start of small groups, and that went okay for a little while, but then he started getting a little overstimulated, so I just took him outside with me, and we sat on the bench, and we just watched stuff on the bench, and we were fine. So I don't have him today. So we'll be on the normal schedule today, and then if we have him next week, we'll just deal with that as well. It'll be just fine. I do have him tomorrow. And tomorrow, I think I'm finally going to just break down and wear my costume when I take him to school. So I've been, when I've had him on Fridays up to this point, I have run back home, got changed, and then gone in. But I thought, you know what, let's just see what happens. So I have a couple of variables here. One of them is, I'm not sure how Aiden will react to me. It's Crazy Paisley Day tomorrow, which means it's a lot of colors and it's a lot of pattern. And so we're just going to give this a try. Worst case scenario, I may need to throw a coat over it, throw some jeans over it just so. But we'll see. We'll see. I think for sight, I think he's okay. We're going to see. It does mean that, I probably need to roll out of bed like at 4:30, grab a quick shower, get dressed, you know, get ready for him to come down at 5:15. And then we'll see. I'm really interested to see how he reacts to it. So we'll see. So that'll be fun. And then I'll have him at school at 6:30, and it will be interesting to see how the preschool workers react to it, because they've never seen me in costume before. So we'll see how this goes. Who knows? May open up a new thing to do, a new place to stop in costume. And as long as it's not a costume, you know, that takes an hour and a half to get into or something like that. The one time before I did, Aiden was with me on a Friday, I got half-dressed, threw on some clothes over it, and then I went home and just finished it up and headed in. And then I shifted my breakfast to 7:30 as opposed to 7, so I can do all those things too. It's a new challenge, so it's always interesting to kind of shuffle things around and do that. I've actually had, as far as the writing goes, I've actually had a couple of people already get back to me with input on the book, so that's good. So beta readers are reading. So that's all good, and I've been writing along on book 22, and that seems to be going fine. I am a little bit behind. I've had a few little disruptions here or there, and I've had a couple of weeks here where I haven't hit 10,000 words. But by the same token, I'm not technically in the writing sprint yet. It doesn't start until October the 1st, and by this weekend, I should already be at like 30,000 words, and that's like 3 weeks into the writing sprint, so I'm ahead. I'm ahead of the timeline. So if I can get to 90,000 words as opposed to 80,000 words, which is the goal of the first sprint, then on the other side of it, it gets a lot easier because it's just coasting. And frankly, we're to the place now where there's only 3 more books left. So if for some reason it would get extended longer, it wouldn't be that big of a deal. I could still get it done in plenty of time. But there's something nice about, yeah, this was the schedule. We hit the schedule. We kept to the schedule for 12 years. and laid it down. So I'd like to be able to say that. And I don't see any reason why I shouldn't be able to say that. Honestly, we still have less than 2 years to go, but it's still 2 years. But it should be fine. It should be fine. So step at a time. Just got to get the words on the page. So all of that's good. So costumes are good. Writing's good. I'm in a little bit of a quandary as to what I want to talk about because I made some notes and that was interesting. But I have been listening to the latest podcast from Brent Weinstein and Heather Hain. Weinstein. I wish I knew how to say that. I wish I could remember how to say that. And they were talking about some really interesting, a really interesting thing. Specifically, they were talking about a collection of articles that was supposedly a scientific study to show the diversity of gender and sex, you know, within whatever context. And part of that context was talking to children about these things. And by their definitions, when they were starting to read the definitions out, which I'm assuming, you know, since this is a big quote-unquote scientific paper, the definitions of a trans person was something like a person who exhibits characteristics that are opposite of their gender assigned at birth. So they were already fudging stuff by using this idea of gender assigned at birth as opposed to sex. They were already fudging things. And what was interesting was they had done this survey of 10-year-olds, and they were asking them questions like, are you transgender? They're 10 years old. And they said what was interesting is there were small percentages of people who said yes, or I think I might be, you know, it's down in the hundreds. For the people who said no, it was like in the thousands. But it was also in the thousands for people said who said, 10-year-olds, who said, I don't know what you're talking about. And that led Heather Hain and Brent Weinstein, I got to get that right, into a whole discussion that was really fascinating. First of all, about the state of the science in terms of how the science is more often done with just models now, as opposed to getting out in the real world and witnessing things. Because a lot of what was being talked about in these surveys and in these demonstrations was done on models. And they got into a really interesting discussion about the comparisons between transgenderism and climate change, how people make these decisions that, well, this must be what this shows, and then they build these models to demonstrate how much it shows that. Except the problem with models is you're only going to include the things in the models that you wish to test, which means you're excluding all of the things that might be different than what you're trying to prove. So that was all very interesting. But they came up with some other really interesting observations about the role that this transgender ideology was playing in society. Because they were saying, rightly so, that sex according to the evolutionary timelines, has actually existed for 500 million years. So what is a male and what is a female, as defined by biological sex, is not assigned at birth. It is what you are, based on the type of machinery that you have to produce gametes. And of course, we've talked about that before, you know, that men produce sperm, the small motile gamete, and women produce eggs, which are the much less motile and much larger and much more complex of the two. It's very straightforward. Has existed for hundreds of millions of years, according to the evolutionist. So it has precedent. What was interesting about their discussion, and then during their discussion, and actually kind of early on, as soon as I heard the definition that was being touted in this paper, I had a thought, which I'll get to in a minute. But one of the things Brent Weinstein brought up that I thought was really very excellent is he was talking about that what we call gender really has also always just been a kind of cultural norm. How do we express some of these underlying roles that we have in our society? Because there are definitely things that are sex-influenced. Men tend to be more interested in things. Women tend to be more interested in people. They aren't required to be more interested in people or required to be more interested in things, but that can occur. And so what we would consider gender in the past, which would be cultural norms, are always mutating and they're always evolving. You know, the classic story that I like to invoke is the idea that pink is for girl and blue is for boys. Because when you're in the late 1800s, there's no notion of that. In fact, all little kids, you know, under a certain age, toddlers and children or young babies and stuff, they're all just dressed in white dresses. You know, because it's easier to change the diaper, it's just white, you're good, whatever. And it's only when you get into the early 1900s and the efforts of the marketers to quantify what you as a parent should buy for, you know, your daughter, or what you should buy for your son, it's only within those contexts do you start to see this idea that there is specific colors for boys as for girls. And the reason for that is it sells more clothing, because in the past, what has happened is clothing for children just got handed down. Sometimes I have a hard time getting the car lined up in the in my garage because I back in. Let me tell you this one more time. So, you know, what we would consider moire or custom, we dress girls in little pink dresses, we dress boys in blue clothes, so that we'll know instantly when we look at boys and girls just by their dress, will know whether they're girls or boys. Which, why is that so necessary for us to do? There's all kinds of things that we could talk about there. But what Brent Weinstein was saying is these things are constantly moving, constantly changing. I don't think we're at a place in our culture now where all girls have to dress in pink and all boys have to dress in blue. And there has certainly been some change. And so whatever the kind of mores are with how you behave and how you dress and your mannerisms aren't necessarily any longer they shouldn't be restricted to certain modes. But the problem is, in order for the transgender ideology to have any traction, it has to override all of that. It has to say, no, there are modes that are clearly defined for men and clearly defined for women. And therefore, any deviation from those norms indicates that, oh, well, you're transgender. And Brent Weinstein's correct analysis of that is, what we've done is we've created the science that's supposed to offer definitive analysis now, that if you happen to be a girl who likes things like trucks, you know, who likes computers, who isn't necessarily gender normative, well, that must mean you're a boy. Because there's no room for any flexibility in there. And by doing that, and vice versa, boys, you know, doing things that would be typical in the norms for women, even though these norms are changing all the time, and modes of dress are changing all the time. By doing that, by enshrining the quote-unquote science and having it all be based on what people feel in terms of their internal identities that they choose based on how they're interfacing to the norms, what we've done is we've concretized concepts of gender. We have overridden this very fluid thing that we have enjoyed as a society, that when we look back over the years, we've seen that these things that at one point we thought, oh, this is only for boys, this is only for girls, that no, there are many modes of behavior, there are many modes of costume, and you don't necessarily have to be a boy to only do these things, or have to be a girl to only do those things. Which leads me to the thought that I had as soon as I heard the definition, that in fact, transgenderism is defined as someone who engages in differences in behavior and styles of dress than the gender that they were quote unquote assigned at birth. And the thought that I have was, wow, that's sexist. That is just flat out sexist. Because basically we're saying, well, for instance, the norm for women is to wear skirts, and women should just wear skirts. Because if women wear pants, well, pants is what men wear. I mean, it is, we've been moving away from this idea that people are confined by their dress or by their occupation or by their demeanor or by their personality types, that we've been moving away from this idea that, yeah, you know, people are people. They have a biological sex, but that biological sex does not necessarily dictate how they must act or how they must dress or the types of jobs they must have or the type of education that has to be available to them, or the type of education that they should be excluded from. All that was sexism. And we've made great progress to divorce ourselves from those things and pull ourselves away from this. And now what we have in the transgender movement is trying to concretize what is the gender attributes that are normative, even though most of the things that they're talking about flex and they mutate and they change. And what is acceptable for men to wear 10 years ago is much different than what is acceptable for men to wear now. If I would go waltzing through Walmart in some of the outfits that I wear 10 years ago, 20 years ago, first of all, I wouldn't do it. But second of all, if I had done that, people would just think I'm some kind of weirdo. Now, they might still think that, but that's okay. It's still, there's enough flexing in it now that I can exploit the tensions in that, and I can get in conversation with tons and tons of people. Had I done that 20 years ago, there's a better than average chance that I would have gotten beat up because it was so different. It was so non-normative. And we have assumed that drifting away from all those quote-unquote normative things was good because it was less sexist. Because we said, just because you're a man or a woman, that doesn't immediately dictate what you wear, where you work, what kind of education, what types of things do you like. It's not a dictate. Women are capable of many other things besides where they got buttonholed for. Men are capable of many other things between what they got buttonholed for. But you can't have definitions of transgenderism without buttonholing the sexes into certain types of roles. Because transgenderism says it's trans, it's moving from one thing to another, transportation, taking one load of something from one place to another. So you have to have a source and a destination if you're going to be transgender. And then therefore, what that does is it drives everything back into these hard definitions that we were moving away from. Simply because you have a group of people that are trying to push this ideology, and the big movers and shakers in this, I interpret them to be really nothing more than those who are trying to capitalize on this idea and make a lot of money from it. Because if you can get someone to sign on to the transgender ideology, and you can get them to believe they're quote-unquote in the wrong body, and you can get them to start down that road of medicalization, you will medicalize them for the rest of their lives. And that is a moneymaker. And that's really what's at the base of all this. As opposed to just saying, you know what, you're a girl, you want to play with trucks, fine, great. You're a guy, you want to play with dolls, fine. And that doesn't even necessarily mean that you're homosexual. You're just a guy that might have some fashion sense about him and might like colors. That's fine. You know, but let's not try to impose on that child some artificial categorization simply because we have this deep-seated need as a society to immediately identify what is male and female. Because honestly, what drives that identification in large part is the reproductive subsystems. And those reproductive subsystems are operating in that categorization as a dehumanizing effect because it's just trying to figure out who can be used as a tool to make babies. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.